I am Joe Bach. I'm here from the University of Notre Dame. And my wife is here, and she's teaching in the Narnia. My wife's name is Sue. She's teaching the young children. And I'm delighted to be here with you today to talk about violence prevention in a broad sense. But in particular, I'll talk with you about, and we will dialogue about how to prevent deadly violence, particularly the kind of violence that's related to identities, identity between groups of people. And oftentimes that's based on religion, ethnicity. It could be based on gang membership, for instance, in a city like Chicago, which we'll be talking about. And so I'm eager to work with all of you, and I hope that some of you, if not all of you, can stay with us throughout the whole week, because the what we do cover in each session is something that builds on the other. One of you asked about the Arab Spring, and before I forget, I need to announce something because this is being recorded. This is the 1st of August, 2011, Holden Village. So this is being taped and it'll be up on the internet. So you should realize that your voice will be beamed out to the whole world if you ask questions today. I hope you're comfortable with that. I am. We're happy to have some of the founders here. Happy to see you here. So anyway, the Arab Spring, as many of you know, do you know what I'm talking about when I mention the Arab Spring? Okay, what is it? So anyway, who wants to define the Arab Spring? Pardon me?
Oh, as I'm mimicking an answer that she gave me.
Okay, please.
Well, no, that's not, it's a private thing.
Oh, okay.
I said we were in East Africa in February, and I said, you know, what we watched on Al Jazeera TV.
Okay, well, that's a pretty good definition, right? So where in East Africa were you?
Tanzania,
okay.
But it was an interesting perspective to be in that hemisphere.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay.
It's view or slideshow.
View. Okay, here we go. So, as I was saying, we'll be talking about collective violence. This is a cover of a strategic plan document that I got when I was in Ethiopia. And this is one of the case studies that I've done in a book that I've been working on. And it's a strategy to try to prevent violence between different African tribes throughout the Horn of Africa, because and that includes Tanzania and Kenya. And the reason that some of these tribes are in conflict is there are multiple reasons, but one of them is that they have land pressure. Some of them are agriculturalists, but most of them are pastoralists. They have cattle, and the problem is that they're having a difficult time keeping their herds fed. Because there are changes in rainfall, their population growth has gone up, and so there has been this conflict over cattle, over grazing, over who has rights to what land. And then on top of that, we've seen more recently the involvement of organized crime. There's an organized crime element, and they're bringing in highly lethal weapons. And of course, this is not one of them. This is an old, it looks like vintage, maybe World War I rifle, but there are automatic weapons that they're bringing in. There's a substantial loss of life. In this group called Conflict Early Warning and Early Response Mechanism is one of the organizations that is out there trying to prevent violence between these different tribes. So they have staff members out in the field who can radio in that there's a problem with a specific tribe, and then they intervene and try to make sure that it doesn't evolve. So what I'd like to do, someone has raised this idea of collective violence related to the Arab Spring, because certainly one of the major challenges that they've had is preventing what is largely a nonviolent movement from turning into a violent movement. So how do they stay on top of what's happening? How do they prevent violence from occurring in isolated places and then spreading like an epidemic? That's a very big challenge. So what would be some other examples of collective violence that you can think of?
Ethnic cleansing.
Ethnic conflict, okay.
Cleansing.
Ethnic cleansing, okay, like in the Balkans, right?
Right.
In Kosovo, etc., as the Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia split up, okay? Ron?
The U.S. war upon the people of Iraq.
Okay. That was, you could definitely call that. Generally speaking, throughout this particular series of courses, we're not going to be focusing substantially on conflict between nation states, but certainly that is a form of collective violence. The field of global health, which is where I work right now at the Institute for Global Health, generally views collective violence at different levels as an epidemic. And what we'll be talking about over this week is how some of the methodologies that are used to predict when disease will outbreak will be highly problematic. Epidemiological approaches are somewhat typical to what people use to identify violence. And so global health kind of looks at those in very similar ways. What would be some other examples of collective violence? Anybody? Well, we talked about gang violence, right?
Drug wars or like in Mexico.
Okay, so a lot of that has to do with organized crime, mm-hmm. Cartels, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Other examples? We heard about ethnic cleansing. There's also what some people would call ethno-religious conflict, like in India, which we'll be talking about. I spent quite a bit of time in Ahmedabad, India. Have you seen the movie Gandhi?
Yes.
Okay. You know when they walked, they were in a place called Ahmedabad when they had the protest march against the British salt law. Remember they made their own salt? Ahmedabad has been subject to considerable ethnic conflict, mainly ethno-religious conflict, mainly between Hindus and Muslims, but more recently with Christians.
Oh, yeah.
And so I've spent a lot of time in Ahmedabad and have studied what different people do to try to prevent ethnic or ethno-religious conflict. So those are just some examples. I put this one here because you can see an African woman carrying a rifle around, and it is indicative of the types of challenges that are facing people in responding to collective violence. Do they arm themselves? What do they do? Okay, so what we're going to be covering over this week are these three primary areas: early warning and early response, again, kind of like epidemiology. We're going to be talking about the use of technology because so many people are interested about the use of Facebook and Twitter and other social media in Iran, in Tunisia, in Egypt. And then we'll be talking some about nonviolence and conflict transformation. In other words, there are certainly components of this in preventing violence that does involve the use of what some people would refer to as nonviolent direct action. And you could say that a lot of what's happened in the Arab Spring has been precisely that, nonviolent direct action. Yes?
Could you describe that Arab Spring?
Sure. So people throughout the world, there have been different changes. For instance, after the downfall of the Soviet Union, you had a number of liberation movements that sprung up in Eastern Europe. And so, you know, Poland with the Solidarity Movement. The Yugoslavia situation was somewhat problematic from an ethnic cleansing standpoint. But different countries, Czechoslovakia broke up into two countries, and they generally became more democratic than they had been. So that was kind of a European spring. It was Eastern Europe that had previously been under the Iron Curtain, and it was then liberated to more democratic forms of governance. So what's happening now within the Arab world are different attempts at political liberation. To some extent, it started with Iran, you could say, with a lot of the protests in Iran. And then in Tunisia, and then in Egypt, and then Yemen. As you know, this very serious conflict in Libya, which is very violent instead of nonviolent. And the question is, how did people make it less violent rather than more violent as a comparison? So does that make sense? The concept of it, it's kind of a springtime political liberation idea. Okay.
Wasn't the Iranian one was a failure from this?
Yes. Case? Yeah, it's been a failure so far. That's right. So it doesn't always work. I mean, sometimes it does, sometimes it does not. And there's been quite a bit of research on the use of nonviolent direct action to bring about political change as compared to the use of violence. And of course, there are theological issues there. I know, Ron, you have a better understanding of, you know, Lutheran just war theory. You know, the Lutheran Church still embraces the just war theory under certain circumstances. I believe it was an Augustinian, St. Augustine, who came up with the initial doctrine. It's really not a theory, it's a doctrine of when war is considered justified. So some people believe that it's better, at least in certain circumstances, to use violence, that you have no other alternative. Others would say that Christ was not, in fact, an advocate of violence, and that they cite evidence that that's the case through theological studies and historical studies. So we ought to be able to get into that in more detail throughout the week, because it's a subject matter I think that a lot of Lutherans, particularly those who are very engaged in the world's social problems, it's a very challenging problem that many of them face. Okay, let's just talk a little bit about early warning systems, and that's what we'll get started on today. I put one up here. There are hurricane early warning systems, right? What would be an example of some other ones?
Tsunami
early warning systems that unfortunately failed, or they weren't in place for some of these past...
Smoke alarms.
That's a great early warning system. I hadn't thought of that one. Great.
Floods.
What's that?
Floods.
Flood early warning systems. Rain. Yes, absolutely.
Earthquake.
Others?
Tornadoes.
Yes, especially if you live in Kansas. I grew up in Kansas City. Okay. Others?
I work at a school and having a lockdown.
A lockdown?
There's someone in the neighborhood with...
Okay.
I thought you were going to go for the head lice.
Headlights early warning.
Early warning head lice.
Yeah, well, that is... It can be kind of an epidemic, right?
Oh, it is an epidemic.
Yeah. Well, we will be talking about school violence, too, this week, about not only school violence and the use of, weapons by school children, but also the problem of bullying, which is a real big problem in this country. Other early warning system ideas?
Well, we live near a power plant, nuclear power plant.
Okay. So if there's going to be a meltdown?
Yeah, they have a...
Okay, that's great. Any others?
Disease outbreaks.
Disease, yes. Epidemiological early warnings, yes. Disease outbreaks.
Bomb sniffing dogs.
What's that?
Bomb sniffing
dogs, yeah, that's an early warning system, sure. Yeah, that's great. Any others?
Our bodies probably give us early warnings.
Okay. Like when somebody's knee starts hurting a lot when they're walking down a mountain. Ron lent his knee brace to my wife as we were walking down from Holden Lake yesterday. She was in substantial pain. Yes, that was an early warning. Definitely. Early warning to take ibuprofen, I think.
Yeah. Blood pressure.
Blood pressure, yeah, that's like an ongoing thing that you use for early warning. Okay. I know in the international humanitarian community, there's a famine early warning system. And you know, there are certain things that you can identify. If farmers, for instance, start eating their seeds, if the families start eating their seeds, then you've got a pretty good sense that things are starting to get so bad that they're going to, if they start slaughtering their cattle, whatever. So those are early warnings too. Okay, so let's go on a little bit. These are the five things that I want to try to cover today. And I want you to ask questions as we go along. We'll be finishing today right around 3:45. We only have an hour. So as we go through these, I want to make sure that you understand them. And each of these should help you understand how to deal with potential violence. That's the reason I put them up here. These are the ones that I've come across that I feel are most helpful. And this is more of the conceptual part of this series of classes that we'll be taking. It's the conceptual, if you will, the theoretical part. Some of these are theories, some of them are really not. It doesn't matter, but it is helpful for you, I think, to understand some of these. We'll talk first about the stages of violence and what is strategic versus what is tactical, okay? I hope that you can read this okay. I'll try to clarify it a little bit. But basically, people talk about violence going through a period of stable relations down here, or durable relations. Sometimes that's called warm peace. And then it moves to where there's considerable tension between different groups. It might be between ethnic Albanian Kosovars and ethnic Serbs. Ethnic Serbs were primarily Orthodox Christians. Ethnic Albanians were primarily, at least nominally, Muslim in Kosovo. So you had ethnic cleansing there. Okay, so you had kind of a cold peace there when there was tension. Then there's low intensity, simmering conflict where people actually start using violence in isolated cases. Okay? And that escalates or de-escalates to massive violence. Okay, so over here on this axis, we have conflict intensity from low to high. And over here, we have time. Okay, so this is generally how people who study international relations and peace and conflict resolution, this is kind of the classic way that they look at it. It's helpful for us in particular because really preventing violence at a local level before it escalates to a war like in Iraq or Afghanistan, or at a local level in a neighborhood before gangs start killing each other, or where organized crime people start killing each other. There's an escalation. There's a period where there's been a lot of tension, and violence prevention, at least in my view, is strategic here. It's also strategic over here. When you're starting to escalate violence, it's strategic to prevent it from escalating. Hence, when we talk about the Arab Spring and we talk about how they were able to bring the downfall of Mubarak, the Mubarak regime that seemed to be incredibly entrenched, right? In fact, our government supported him for years. It's amazing that roughly it was somewhere between 800 and 900 people who died in doing that. Now compare that to Libya. In Libya, it's been what? It's been in the tens of thousands, if not the hundreds of thousands. And they're still unresolved. I'm not saying that the so-called Arab Spring in Tunisia and Egypt is a, you know, we don't know at this point how it's going to turn out. But we do know that overthrowing dictators was possible using a primarily nonviolent method. And they were able to prevent irritating the police and army to the point that they didn't make them crack down on them in ways that they would have if they would have really, in a sense, made them hostile towards them. They got the population on their side, the relatives of the police, the relatives of the army. They got them on their side. They handed them out flowers, like in the overthrow of Milosevic in Serbia. In fact, The Serbian youth movement advised the youth movement in Egypt. The Tunisian youth movement advised the youth movement of Egypt. It's an amazing form of international solidarity on strategy, on tactics, etc. But they were able, at this stage, in a sense, to contain it. One of the things you have to understand in this work and in dealing with this stuff is that the conflict is not necessarily a bad thing. In fact, sometimes conflict is useful. Sometimes conflict helps people overcome problems that they have. The question is, how do people act out that conflict? Do they become violent or not? Do they become aggressive or not? Are they assertive? Do they use techniques that doesn't harm human life and still gets their point across? Do they litigate? In our country, we can litigate. We've got the rule of law. I've been in countries all over the world where there's really no rule of law. There's absolute corruption. They have a really hard time. Egypt was one of them, absolute corruption. But these young people still were able to pull it off. And it was in stage A. They prevented it from going to stage B. Libya has failed in doing that. And then when you get to a point where, to some extent, you're in a post-massive violent stage, you need to prevent, they call them, in the literature, they call the people the spoilers, the people who spoil the peace that has come across over this struggle, whether it was violent or nonviolent. You've got to prevent the spoilers from ruining it. I call these people over here the troublemakers. You had a lot of troublemakers in Cairo, right? You had the people who broke into the museum, right? Over here, you've got the spoilers. You've got the people who, they had something to gain from the violence. They were arms dealers, right? They had a job. They were in the army. They had a job. Now they can't get a job. These are the spoilers. So this is a helpful way. Stages of violence. Up here, to do early warning at a local level is not strategic. It is strategic in A and C, not in B. Does that make sense to everybody?
What did you just say? It wasn't strategic?
It's not strategic. So here, if you prevent escalation of violence, that's strategic. It has a macro impact over the whole country, like it did in Egypt, right? Or over a region of a country. Whereas if it keeps going up and you're preventing violence at a local level, it's probably saving human life and therefore it's of intrinsic value, right? But it's really not having an impact on the overall macro level. It's not really strategic. It's only tactical in stage B. In A and in C, when you're dealing with troublemakers over here and spoilers over here, you're trying to put out the embers of violent conflict, and in those cases, it is strategic. If you don't counteract the spoilers in C, you're going to have oscillations. And this is something that I disagree with a lot of the literature in conflict resolution. They talk about the cycles of violence. It's really oscillations of violence. So look at this one up here, and keep in mind the different categories. So you've got massive violence, durable relations, remember that continuum. So the idea, you get conflict oscillations. Sometimes there's a brief eruption of violence, like in Sri Lanka, where I spent a lot of time working with a group doing conflict early warning. There was a horrible massacre by the Sri Lankan government of ethnic Tamils. Tamils are primarily Hindu. There are also a lot of them who are Muslim, to a much smaller amount, and some who are Christian. The Sinhalese are primarily Buddhists. The Sinhalese are the overwhelming majority of people there in Sri Lanka. And so you had, for instance, like a massive an escalation after the police just massacred all kinds of Tamils. And then for decades, you had that pattern, violence over time. You had conflict oscillations. And it went to the massive scale. It went up to the B area, okay? What you're trying to do with circumventing violence is either this, afterwards you're stopping the spoilers, right? Or you're preventing it from ever going up to massive conflict. So these are kind of three patterns that you try to keep in mind when you're analyzing something like violent conflict and how it evolves over time. Okay, now this one here is a framework that was developed by Donald Horowitz. He's on the faculty at Duke University, and he wrote this book, which I've cited up here, called The Deadly Ethnic Riot. And this is, in my opinion, one of the most valuable frameworks of understanding collective violence, not necessarily between nation states, where you've got this all kinds of, frankly, convoluted theory and theology, which makes people feel like it's okay to kill each other, but between collective groups. I just want to explain this real quickly, and I want to make sure you get this, so please ask questions if it isn't clear. There are three dimensions to collective violence. The first are underlying conditions, and so you start out with a hostile relationship that people have. So, okay, let's go back to ethnic cleansing. Why was it that the Serbs and the Kosovars, the ethnic Albanians in Kosovo, they were all part of Yugoslavia, right? Why did the Serbs why did the ethnic Albanians rebel against being part of Greater Serbia after Tito died? How had they been treated? I mean, who had been the dominant ethnic group in the former Yugoslavia?
Serbs.
The Serbs. So the other people, I mean, in Kosovo, when I was with American Refugee Committee based in Minneapolis, we had all kinds of, after the ethnic cleansing, we had refugee resettlement programs. It's unbelievable the stories that you would hear. Some of the staff members that we even had, they saw ethnic Albanians who were in the Kosovo province almost like a lot of people think of gypsies, which are really called Roma. A lot of the ethnic Albanians also have Roma living among them. They're actually, you know what I'm talking about when I say gypsies. They're actually Roma, Askalis, and there's one other. There are actually three different ethnic groups among Roma. But what you have is you had a dominant group of Serbs and a kind of a looked down upon group of ethnic Albanians in Kosovo. So all of a sudden, you've got Tito dying, you've got the Iron Curtain coming down, you've got the potential for political transformation, but you have no safeguards of basic human rights. And then you've got the heavily militarized, how should I say it, heavy materiel wielding Serbia. In other words, they had the tanks, they had the heavy artillery. They start attacking this rebel group of ethnic Albanians. And it became what? It became ethnic cleansing. So the question is, and this is what Horowitz points out, there's a hostile relationship, generally, between people of different ethnic identities. In this case, it was ethno-religious. The Serbs versus the primarily, remember, Orthodox Serbs versus the primarily, and they were really nominally, and by that I mean they weren't really practicing Muslims, but they viewed themselves, most of them weren't, most of them viewed themselves as Muslims, ethnic Albanians. And certainly religion has kind of resurfaced in substantial ways since a lot of these countries have gone, since the Iron Curtain has come down. Okay, so there's a hostile relationship, and then there's something called a precipitating event. A precipitating event would be something like, let me give you an example of a precipitating event. In Kenya, those of you who are in Tanzania, you probably follow Kenya too, and I can see you like Tusker beer, so you're a dead giveaway. So in Kenya, there was an election in 2008, right? And this is one thing that we have trouble with, because a lot of other countries, they don't view themselves as in the sense of being a member of a nation state. In other words, like we view ourselves as Americans or whatever. There, they view themselves as a member of a clan or a tribe, right? So, yeah.
But wasn't the nation state forced on them by Europeans?
Yes, that's a great point. So it's kind of like, I'm glad you mentioned that, Ron. So a lot of these ethnic groups and so-called tribes were really, yeah, they were like artificial borders that were the colonial powers. They drew the maps. And so you've got political chaos in large part because of that, of those drawing of the maps, and because of colonialism, etc. So, and because of slavery. So anyway, in Kenya, you've got different tribal groups, and you've had one that's been dominating, right? So after the election in 2008, there was a sense that there had been fraud, right? It was considered a fraudulent election. So if you're part of the ethnic group that lost out in that election, and you feel that the election was rigged, what happens? It blows up, and that's what happened in Kenya. So that was a precipitating event. That's my point. The election, which was perceived widely as being rigged, was a precipitating event. So those are the two underlying conditions that Donald Horowitz talks about as being important. And then this is the interesting thing, and we'll talk about the different patterns. The interesting thing that not very many people, at least in political science and peace studies, had really considered, and Horowitz compared 150 ethnic cases of mainly ethnic and ethno-religious violence from all over the world. And he says, and he determined that there was a lull between a precipitating event and the onset of violence. There's a time dimension. There's a lull, like the lull before the storm. Think back to the Wizard of Oz. Of course, remember I was talking about Kansas, tornadoes, early warning. They saw the storm and before the tornado came, right? There's a lull before the storm. Dorothy and Toto were out, you know, and Mrs. Wicked Witch is out on her bike with her basket on the back, remember? All that's happening right before the tornado. So there's a lull there between the precipitating event and the onset of violence. Now this is really important when it comes to who can you reasonably expect can intervene to prevent violence. If there's a short lull, people nearby can intervene, right? If there's a long lull, that's much less important. You can have, you know, peacekeepers come in. You can call in the police. You can call in the military. You can call in the conflict transformation experts. You know, like these people at the Harvard Negotiation Project who do it all over the world, who do mediation, right? You call them in. They fly in. They negotiate. So the lull, and usually what Horowitz found was, is that there are usually rumors. They start flying around during the lull. Okay? But something's going to happen. Like in Rwanda, before the genocide. There, everybody knew that the lists were being developed of the Tutsis who were going to get slaughtered in genocide. They had addresses, they had names. Everybody knew it. What was the name of the human rights organization? I can't remember the name. I think it was Amnesty International. They came out with warnings. There's going to be genocide in Rwanda. Okay? So, now, the processes that occur during a lull. Now, I'm calling this consensus building theory because that's really what Horowitz offers us. How consensus is built. Consensus to kill. Consensus to kill occurs during the lull between the precipitating event and the onset of violence. So there's acute emotional engagement. There's justification for killing. They raped a woman of our ethnic identity. This is the beginning of more rapes. They're going to rape all of our women. And we all know that rape is used as an instrument of violence. Okay? I'm angry about that. I have hatred in my heart towards those people because of that. This act was not an act against a single individual. It was an act against all of us, of our group, with our identity. You see what I mean? Exaggeration of threat. Again, was this a criminal act? Was the rape a criminal act that was conducted by one or a small group of people who were drunk or high? Or was it a political act? And oftentimes in these circumstances, you have a consensus that that it's a bigger threat than it really is. It's an exaggeration of threat. Okay, the Crips and the Bloods. The Crips had beaten up one of the Bloods in Los Angeles, and we know that they're going to be attacking our turf soon, so we need to go to Walmart and buy some automatic weapons and some ammunition. Okay? So the exaggeration of threat is there. And then here's the other one that's really interesting. Reduction of the risk of the people who are allegedly planning to do the killing, planning to attack. They feel, now in Africa and in other places, there are all kinds of examples of people going through with shamans, with priests or whomever, in vulnerability practices. God is on our side. You've got armor on you, you're not going to get killed. Right? So you can see how hostile relationship, you've got some really emotional precipitating event that occurs, then your emotions become really strong, like how you would feel if your daughter had been raped or your son had been beaten to a pulp or killed. You feel like it's justified, and believe me, there's a lot of when you get to justification for a killing, religion is highly problematic. Religion is a beautiful thing, but I say it's a double-edged sword. And sadly, my own view is that religion is usually like a butter knife on the side of peace and like a sword on the side of hatred and violence, because it is so potent. And on the side of peace, it takes cultivation of an interior state in a collective sense of restraint. And that's a difficult thing. It's over a period of time where you have spiritual formation. So it's a butter knife there. It works. It works. But it's kind of like trying to cut steak with a butter knife, right? It's pretty frustrating. It's not real quick. Whereas on the side of hatred, if you have a person that you revere, a holy man or a holy woman or a group of holy people who say, we've got to teach those people a lesson. Right? It's not only something that we need to do, we have a sacred duty to do it. Killing in the name of God. So religion is highly problematic. When it comes to justifying killing, religion is great. Pull it out. Pull out all the stops on whatever kind of theology you can get your hands on. Go and find some of the most narrow-minded people who are respected religious leaders and let them announce on the loudspeakers, on the radio, to try to have an impact on getting people to teach those other people a lesson. And I saw it happen in Pakistan when my family and I lived there. There was a village called Shanti Nagar and another smaller one called Tiba Colony. Christian families. there was a huge Muslim community next to it. Allegedly, somebody who was selling liquor can't be sold to Muslims in Pakistan, but Christians can have liquor in Pakistan. In fact, my friends and I, we were able to buy beer and hard liquor. They didn't have wine there. But we had to go to a priest to certify that we were Christians. And we call that our infidel permit. And I don't mean any disrespect by that. It's an interesting example of what a lot of people call tolerance in a Muslim country. And anyway, we had somebody who was in a... I'm just giving you an example here of how it unfolds sometimes. Somebody in Shantinagar had a place where he sold liquor. It was kind of a, from the standpoint of the Muslims, it was kind of a speakeasy because a lot of Muslims went over into this village because they could get liquor there, right? And he was also, there was also gambling going on there. And apparently the police officers knew about this. They were Muslim. The police officers knew about it. And so this, you know, kind of this gambling place, liquor store place, they come in one day and they demand a higher payoff. They were making money off of it, right? And the head of this person said, oh, that's outrageous, I'm not going to pay that amount. So the people who were making money, or the police officers were infuriated by this, and so they tore some pages out of the Quran and dropped them on the floor in there. And this resulted in allegations that the person running the, you know, the liquor gambling place was blaspheming. And so then these police officers went to the muftis. That there was a that there had been a blasphemy occur, and the muftis announced over loudspeakers that they felt that the Christians needed to be taught a lesson. So a mob formed, and they went and they torched Shantinagar and Tiba Colony. Only one person died. It was of a heart attack by one of the attacking group, but considerable damage of property occurred. Tractors were torched, ruined. Irrigation pumps were ruined. Houses were burnt down, at least the wooden parts of what were basically mud houses in this village. Now, the hostile relationship was largely a function of the fact that you had families living in different places. They were ethnically pure communities. They didn't really interact a lot. Not only that, but kind of counterintuitive of what you would think, the Christians were better off than the Muslims, even though they were discriminated against in Pakistan. The reason was is the missionaries came in and gave them good educations. They immigrated. They got good jobs. They sent their money back. So here are these people who are Christians, who are considered, you know, they're people of the book in Islam, but they're Pakistan, you have to realize it's an Islamic republic, and there is discrimination towards non-Muslims. And so there's a sense that these Christians, why are they better off than we are? You know, they're driving tractors, and we're still using our water buffalo to plow our fields, right? So there was this hostile relationship that had grown over a period of time. And then you had the throwing of the Quran onto the ground in the location of the liquor store, and that was a precipitating event. And then it took them a while to build consensus. The muftis provided the justification, right? They didn't feel like there was any risk because the police was on their side, right? It wasn't so much that there was a threat to them, but they perceived it as a threat to their religion or as a heinous act, something that needed to be corrected. Not that they just ought to help to take care of the Christians, but that they had a sacred obligation to do so. Right? So this is a basic framework, which I think is one of the most useful frameworks to understand how this kind of collective violence unfolds. Okay? And I want to, there was one last one here that a friend of mine, John Paul Lederach, pointed out to me, a sense that there are no other options. And you'll see that this is brought up in other frameworks that we'll cover. A sense that there are no other options. Okay, so what do? You take these people to court. What could the head of the, gambling / liquor establishment have done? Could he have taken those police to court?
No.
No. The courts don't really work that well. What could the people in Kenya do after the election that they perceived to be rigged? What were their options?
Do nothing.
Do nothing or become violent. At least that's how they felt. And it was kind of like one of those "we're not going to take it anymore" situations, right? So they feel like they really have no options. I mean, they didn't have a bunch of, and I'm overstating this, but they didn't have a bunch of young people who planned, who expected the election in Kenya to be rigged. They thought, this is par for the course, right? We better get ready for a strategy that we can implement if, in fact, it is rigged. And then we need to execute that strategy right away. If it comes out that they've rigged the election, they say that the current, regime is going to stay in power, and we need to know what we're going to do. It requires strategy, et cetera, prior planning. And that was not something that had been done in Kenya. It is something that had been done in Egypt and in Tunisia. Okay, so that's one framework. And again, to me, that's the most helpful one.
Joe?
Yes, Ron?
Yeah, I know you don't want to talk about nations, but just as you were talking there, the lull between 9/11 and our attack on Iraq.
Right.
I mean, that's not only is that the playbook of Bush and Cheney, but the news media just did everything they could do to pour gasoline on the fire.
And this was the gasoline on the fire?
That was the playbook of our government.
Right.
To create, during the lull.
Right.
No other options.
No other options. What else can we do? We need to attack them.
Weapons of mass destruction.
Right.
We can kill them because they're godless people. They've been raping the women. All these kinds of stuff.
Right. Well, that's really, I mean, Ron, I'm glad you point that out. In international relations, they call it something called the level of analysis problem, and it's kind of, it goes back to the philosophy of science, where they'll say, you can't if a theory is developed or a phenomenon that you've identified conceptually occurs at one level, it's what they would call an epistemological error to say that it applies to another level. So there's the level of the individual, the level of groups, collectivities, and then there's the level of the nation state and the international system. So those are different levels. So what you just said, I think, is true, but people in the field of international relations would say you're making a level of analysis leap that is probably, from the standpoint of the development of knowledge anyway, an epistemological error. In other words, an error in the way that you're handling the understanding of it. But I'm not saying it's wrong. It could be true. And these things might also happen at an individual level. Right?
I'm thinking of the man in Norway. And as we've been talking, I'm thinking individual.
Right.
Whether these things can be applied
to
individuals.
Yeah.
And that person specifically.
Right. That's a good point. I mean, it could. I mean, maybe he felt like he didn't have any other options than to go out and just kill people. Maybe, for him, there really was no risk. He didn't care if he was thrown in jail, right?
I think he expected to be killed, and they didn't come to kill him.
Yeah. So, I mean, all I'm saying is I think it probably does apply, at least to some extent. We just have to be a little bit careful about using this conceptual framework on different levels of aggregations of people, whether at the individual or groups, collective groups, nation state, international system. So I'm glad you brought that up. Okay. Now, I just wanted to go over this for a little bit. The most usual scenario, according to Horowitz, and this is kind of the pattern of how violence unfolds, the most usual scenario is that there's a precipitating event. That's what these dots are, right? You've got the history of enmity the whole time. This is kind of putting it on a timeline, right? So you've got the classic case, precipitating event, then there's a lull, and then there's violence. That's the top one. That's the classic one. Okay? This other one is, there's a history of enmity, there's a precipitating event, there's no lull, and then there's violence. That was Kenya. That was Kenya in 2008. Why?
No option.
They kind of knew it was coming.
Okay, no options, but they knew it was coming. They built consensus before it happened. Okay, not only did they not develop an understanding of strategy of what to do if it happened so that they could, you know, be more effective than just go out and start lashing out and killing people, but they, and I'm not trying to be critical, this is a hard situation for people in Kenya, really a hard situation, but I'm just saying that I'm trying to contrast it with Egypt and Tunisia, but in this particular case, they didn't need a lull, they were expecting it, and they were ready to be violent if in fact their predictions came right. They had built consensus over here, right? So that's a less typical pattern, according to Horowitz. That doesn't happen very often. And then there's another one where you've got, like, and you know, we don't really know with any certainty how often this works, but it's kind of like, okay, there's a precipitating event, there's a lull, then there's violence, and then there's a, and then it just oscillates. It just keeps going. There are violent patterns. They just keep erupting and erupting in societies. And that's what Sri Lanka was. And then it broke out into what would be called a separatist revolt because the Tamil Tigers wanted, the LTTE, Tamil Tigers, wanted to break off the top part of the island in the eastern province away from the Sinhalese-dominated Sri Lankan government. And what was it? It was like since the 1980s, right? Since that massacre by the police of the Tamils. Last year or the year before? That whole time, you had this. You had this happening. It was horrible. Sri Lanka had been one of the best. It was when I was in getting my doctorate, and I studied economic development in developing countries, Sri Lanka was considered one of the best examples of what they call growth with equity. In other words, growth by investing in education, by investing in land reform, by making sure that people have the means of production, that they have an education, that the literacy rate is high. That was Sri Lanka. It was one of the countries that had done that. And then it blows up. And it degenerated. I never will forget, my wife Sue and I were in Colombo, Sri Lanka in 2008 when I was working on this research. And Sue volunteered to write a report of a museum of photography of the violence and the ethnic cleansing over time. Now, it wasn't necessarily ethnic cleansing. In a way it was. But it was identity-based conflict. It was Tamil against mainly the government, and the government was predominantly Sinhalese. It wasn't totally Sinhalese Buddhist, not totally. And it certainly was not a Buddhist government. The government was comprised of the majority of the people in that island. And then you had religion as being somewhat problematic because Sri Lanka is considered the golden kingdom of Buddhism by many Buddhists. The island of Ceylon is considered the golden kingdom of Buddhism. And so there was this kind of this religious nationalism that poisoned Sri Lanka, frankly. Kind of like what you've got with other countries when they say, this is our land, this is the promised land, and this is our land. in international relations, they call those sons of the soil conflicts. In other words, when you have identity and religion attached to land, which is what it was in Sri Lanka, the island of Ceylon is sacred to all Buddhists, right? We have to hold on to it. It's the golden kingdom of Buddhism, right? So I'm just trying to give you an example of how religion is confounding in terms of some of the unfolding of this violence. Anyway, I was telling you, my wife Sue was doing an evaluation of this museum that was kind of it was designed to kind of help people release their emotions of the tragedy of the separatist revolt, of all the people who had been killed, of all the suicide bombers. In Sri Lanka, they perfected having women be suicide bombers. It's horrible, horrible conflict. And the island of Sri Lanka, have any of you ever been there? Beautiful place, isn't it? I mean, just a beautiful place. I guess I kind of fell in love with it, but the name of the display of the pictures was so telling, and this was the project that Sue evaluated. The name of the display was Paradise in Tears. And they had this cover of the literature that they spent, and it kind of goes back to what you were talking about earlier, Ron. These were Sri Lankans who looked like British, they were former British colony. They looked like they had British military outfits on, beating their own people with sticks. Paradise in Tears, that's what it said. And it was such a great way to put it, because Sri Lanka is kind of a paradise type of island, and it is an island in tears, and it's still an island in tears because of the horrific human rights abuses that occurred during that last military campaign. So I don't need to go on and on about that. Anyway, here are the different patterns that Horowitz points out. Now, I want to talk with you about something. This is a real simple idea, but it's an important one. Oh, and I'm sorry, we're running out of time. There are a lot of people talk about grievances. You know, people talk about, well, they were really mad because the Moi regime won the election in Kenya, right? That was a grievance. Usually, violence doesn't occur unless somebody is taking a leadership role in making it happen. And that's where this person, Paul Collier, he's at Oxford University, he came up with this concept of the greed-grievance nexus. So keep that in mind this week, the greed-grievance nexus. Conflict doesn't happen mechanistically. It isn't just that there's a grievance and people rebel. It's that there's a grievance and then there are people who say, we're not going to take it anymore. And some of them want to get into political office. I saw in India that some of them wanted conflict in the slums because there was this, it's kind of another unforeseen idea. If you go into a plot of land in the city of Ahmedabad, even if it's a slum, and you live there for a certain period of time, you can't, according to the law, be pushed off of it. However, if there's a riot and you end up evacuating the slum, bring the bulldozers in. Hey, I'm a real estate developer. I'm going to go hire a group of thugs. I'm going to pay them with liquor or money or sex, which is what they do. And they're going to start a riot. And then all these people are going to go. I've got the bulldozers already. Greed, grievance, nexus. Okay? So they act like they go out and they let's say it's a Muslim slum, and you go after some of these Hindu militant groups, hire them. You know, these so-called thugs. And I don't mean to belittle them as human beings, because of course they've got to have a lot of sadness in their hearts after they reflect on what they did. But keep in mind, if you will, Horowitz's framework, the cycles of violence, remember the escalation to de-escalation, and the grievance nexus, and we'll get further into this later on this week. It's time to stop. Thank you very much, everybody, for being here today.